Welcome back, dear listeners. This is the second installment of Virtual Memories Radio. First one was last October, which makes it almost 5 months since I've sat down and recorded something. The reasons for this tend to revolve around my general sense of anxiety and fear that I don't have anything to really say in this world. But I'm getting over that, I promise. Lately, I've been listening a lot to Mark Maron's WTF pod, which, if you care about comedy or good conversation, you really should listen to. I would say I'm inspired by Maron's work, at least in terms of offering up a sort of confessional semi-rant at the beginning of a podcast and being less afraid of, well, of talking into the void. Those of you who know me know that, well, you may think that I'm in love with the sound of my own voice, but really it's like the sound of one hand wanking, as it were, which I guess is sort of a Zen koan of sorts. One of the main reasons I didn't get back to recording right away was this this phenomenon I experienced called, something that I call acquisitive alchemy. It's this belief that you have to sort of own exactly the right things, and once you have them all in place, then you'll be perfect. In my youth and my college years and beyond, it really evinced itself on my bookshelf, where I had to just have the right books, not necessarily have read them, but somehow hunting down certain books that were difficult to find, like The Recognitions, an early Pynchon book also, or a chapbook of his, Mortality and Mercy in Venice, that by having those things, simply by ownership, somehow there would be a certain alchemy. I would be made better. I'd be made a writer. That isn't the case. I'm not really a writer. I blog, and I'm a pharmaceutical trade magazine editor, but writing, I haven't done. Anyway, I'm not sure if acquisitive alchemy is really just a nicer term for the collector mentality or for mindless consumerism. I mean, it's all the same thing, I suppose, this idea that you have to just keep acquiring things as opposed to settling into yourself and working from there. And I'm working on myself now, as it were. I'm trying to improve certain aspects of myself, which I guess is where that alchemy idea comes in, the base metal being the soul that needs to be transformed into gold. I don't know. And for a while, I wouldn't do a podcast unless I had exactly the correct microphone and the correct mixing board and the correct software, and I didn't acquire any of those, and I thought about it, but I've concluded for the moment I'll work with this USB mic I bought a few years ago and this windsock thing, and I'll go from there. And if I figure out that, you know, those other things are necessary to make this better, then I'll pick them up too. For the nonce, I'm again really apologetic that you only can listen to my voice on this. I'm hoping to get some interviews done. I'd like to either sit down on Skype and talk to someone remotely, or even better, sit down in person. I've got a couple of topics I'd like to make recurring features here, but anyway, that's a skinny. That's what brings us to this second installment of Virtual Memories Radio. I guess what you need to do is to quote Henry Miller, which we should all do more often, although not too much. In Tropic of Cancer, near the very beginning, he tells us, "To sing, you must first open your mouth. You must have a pair of lungs and a little knowledge of music. It is not necessary to have an accordion or a guitar. The essential thing is to want to sing. This, then, is a song. I am singing." You should note there will not actually be any singing by me on this blog at all, on this podcast at all. Maybe I'll play some neat music like that intro we just had, which actually I should tell you about. That was, and you'll get more bits of it over the course of this, a song called Into Everything by Telepop Music, this French techno ambient thing that I groove on. They have a floating selection of vocalists. That one was a woman named Deborah Anderson, who is the daughter of the frontman for Yes, John Anderson, the high-pitched guy from Runaround and songs like that. At first, I was a little disturbed that he has a daughter who's adult enough to have a full recording career. And she has an album of her own called Silence that's kind of nice. I've only listened to it a few times, but I sort of dig it. What's more disturbing is the fact that her voice is so much deeper than his, I guess. That's really kind of bizarre that, you know, simply no musical lessons, or at least vocal lessons, he could have given her growing up, given, well, his voice and what normal human beings sound like. Anyway, the thing I want to talk about this time, before we get around to doing interviews, which I promise will be our next installment, is Invisible Cities, the book that I read at the beginning of our first installment. I read you the first couple of pages. It's a really beautiful book by Talio Calvino, and it's... You can say it's about Kublai Khan sending Marco Polo around his empire to report back and tell him about the wonders of the cities that he visits. That's a prosaic way of describing it. It's really these wonderful, little, beautiful jewels of cities that Calvino writes about. They're unreal cities, but the descriptions are absolutely gorgeous and wonderful, and they all fit into various themes. There's a numerical component to it all, as there is with a bunch of Calvino's works. But what I want to tell you about is how I discovered Invisible Cities. It came from a teacher in high school, a man named Mr. Blake, Joe Blake. My mom and I moved to Pennsylvania my senior year of high school. I knew nobody, but met a bunch of people through the... Well, I met a bunch of people. I made good friends. People who took care of me, and Joe Blake was one of the guys who I don't believe I had a class with, but with whom I formed a good bond. He was an English teacher, and I think he recognized who I was, and he recognized how dramatic and pretentious, etc., and everything else I was. But he also recognized, I think, how lonely that person I was can get. And at graduation, he gave me a copy of Invisible Cities, and I read it that summer, I believe. And it's, like I say, it's a wonderful book, but the ending of it is what Mr. Blake wanted me to pay attention to, and he inscribed the last words in the front of the book. And I read an excerpt of it, so here you go. Let me just give you the final pages. Spoiler alert, final pages for a book written in 1972 and translated in 1974, so I think the statute of limitations has expired, but here's the close as Kublai Khan and Marco Polo talk about all the cities they visited, and what remains. The Great Khan's Atlas also contains the maps of the Promised Lands, visited in thought, but not yet discovered or founded. New Atlantis, Utopia, the City of the Sun, Oceania, Timoa, New Harmony, New Lanark, Icaria. Kublai asked Marco, "You, who go about exploring and who see signs, can tell me toward which of these futures the favoring winds are driving us?" Marco answered, "For these ports, I could not draw a route on the map or set a date for the landing. At times, all I need is a brief glimpse, an opening in the midst of an incongruous landscape, a glint of lights in the fog, the dialogue of two passers-by meeting in the crowd, and I think that, setting out from there, I'll put together, piece by piece, the perfect city, made of fragments mixed with the rest, of instants separated by intervals, of signals one sends out, not knowing who receives them. If I tell you that the city toward which my journey tends is discontinuous in time and space, now scattered, now more condensed, you must not believe the search for it can stop. Perhaps while we speak, it is rising, scattered, within the confines of your empire. You can hunt for it, but only in the way I have said." Already the great Khan was leafing through his atlas, over the maps of the cities that menace and nightmares and maledictions. Enoch, Babylon, Yahuland, Butua, Brave New World. He said, "It is all useless if the last landing place can only be the infernal city, and it is there that, in ever-narrowing circles, the current is drawing us." And Polo said, "The inferno of the living is not something that will be. If there is one, it is what is already here, the inferno where we live every day, that we form by being together. There are two ways to escape suffering it. The first is easy for many. Accept the inferno, and become such a part of it that you can no longer see it. The second is risky and demands constant vigilance and apprehension. Seek and learn to recognize who and what, in the midst of the inferno, are not inferno. Then make them endure. Give them space." So that was Mr. Blake. He saw an 18-year-old, manic, over-intellectualizing writer. He knew I'd be trapped in the inferno, the idiocracy, and he offered the best advice he knew. He gave me this gift, and it meant the world to me. Mr. Blake died of a stroke in 1992. He was only 36. I never thought about how young he was, but I'm 4 years older than that now, and I've been editing trade magazines longer than he was a teacher, and I can't pretend I touched as many lives as he did. I go back to Invisible Cities every few years, and I reminisce about him. And sometimes, you know, when I'm visiting a new city for a conference, I think about Marco Polo and Kublai Khan. If you've made it this far, thanks for listening. This is the end of our second episode, and I promise the next one will be cheerier. I can't promise it'll be up anytime soon, but it definitely will be cheerier.